Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, boys and girls. What do they say at Disneyland? Boys, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. This is Trish Lambert, the Tolkien Maven, here with another episode or a session of the Silm Film Project, and I'm led by Corey Olson, the Tolkien professor. Dave unfortunately can't be with us today, which is why you're hearing my dulcet tones, but we'll do our best.
That's right. Yeah, welcome everybody. I'm really looking forward to today's session. Today's session is really fun. I love this idea. This is one of the new things that we're doing. We did this before, but it's still new because it's only the second time, only session of its kind we've had so far. And that is the desire. One of the things that we're wanting to correct this year is to spend more time during the season talking about and sort of giving some input for the creative work that people are doing, and in our online community here, our Silm Film community. So we're going to be talking about several questions and issues that have come up, a bunch of kind of fun miscellaneous things to discuss and think about, which I'm really looking forward to doing. Last time we had one of these sessions, we ended up getting caught up in discussing the frame, which was great because we hadn't really been thinking about the frame. So I'm really super glad that we did that. But we left a bunch of other questions on the table. So we're going to go back and cover a bunch of that stuff here today. So that's what we're going to be talking about. Lots of really fun theoretical issues, the kind of thing which would be a digression in any other session, but is the central thing that we're talking about today. So that's going to be fun.
So watch, we'll end up talking about episode content.
That's right. So we're going to digress. And sorry, we'll digress onto discussing episode 5 accidentally. Yeah, probably so, knowing us. Okay. First, a couple quick announcements. One, just a reminder that Mythmoot is coming up at the end of June. Registration actually closes after, I think, the first week of June. So we're now in the last 2-3 weeks to sign up for Mythmoot if you haven't yet. Reminder about Mootcast, that Mootcast is now happening. You can now register for full live streaming content of Mythmoot, all of the sessions, all of the weekend of Mythmoot, and also access to a digital archive recording of all those. So even if you want to see concurrent sessions, you can go back and watch them. And that's available also to anyone who attends any part of Mythmoot in person as well. So just a reminder about that. A very special event this week on Sunday, May 19th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, Thesis Theater with Trish Lambert. Our own Trish Lambert is going to be presenting her thesis, and it's going to be a lot of fun. You want to talk about that a little bit, Trish? Tell people what's coming up.
I'll tell people, a little bit what's going on. It's a long time coming. The thesis of my thesis is that the Lord of the Rings Online, which all of you know that Corey and I play and actually are quite involved in, is actually literary. And to a larger extent than that, expands the question out to, are video games literary and what would constitute that? And my answer is yes, any more than a book or a movie is literary, some more so than others. So, I mean, that's the answer. But to really talk about that, I guess my ulterior motive also was sort of to spotlight this the amazing work that they do there, is specifically in Rohan and Dunland, and looking at the way that it's literary is that the developers, whether they knew they did this or not, have used very classic literary archetypes that any reader would recognize. And it's those archetypes that allow the players in the game to really get immersed in the game. And so I use Dante's Inferno for a big chunk of my examples. And going into it, even doing it was even more, I got even more out of it, than I had when I first got the idea going through. And so it's the reason for Dante is because what they've done in the game is they've really represented the impact that Saruman is having both in Dunland and Rohan without ever really showing him much. You don't mm-hmm. see him very much, mm-hmm. but you feel his impact throughout. And it's very believable. Plus, where there would be one Wormtongue, there's bound to be more, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so it's so believable when you go into Rohan and you really get invested and you meet and you really get involved in the society. It's amazing. And they stayed true to Tolkien, which I interviewed Chris Pearson, who's the world builder, and you know, he shared with me sort of, you know, what they did to create these two lands, because they're not really very well sketched by Tolkien.
Right. Right.
And
especially
really
Dunland, obviously.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Especially Dunland, like one sentence, I think.
Right. Exactly. We get almost nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
no, it's
so
great.
It'll be really interesting.
Yeah,
yeah,
I mean,
so
I've been saying for a long time that I think that The Lord of the Rings Online is one of the best adaptations of Tolkien I've ever seen, I know of. But you know, Trish, I think that it's so important. A lot of people, doesn't even occur to people to think about video games and the way that video games are constructed, mm-hmm. even as like adaptation, you know, mm-hmm. exactly in that way. But no, the kind of storytelling and world building and just the kind of analysis of Tolkien's text that has gone into that game and the plot,
yeah,
and story
absolutely.
Writing and dialogue and text of that game. Very, very interesting and definitely stuff worth writing about and thinking about, I think. So that's
in a larger sense, I honestly think that future generations, the way they will consume literature, I mean, let's face it, Shakespeare wasn't literature when he was alive, right? So
right.
let's
right.
It's about what do we mean by literature, right? But I think the way that literature will be recognized and consumed in the future is through multimedia channels, is through graphic novels and games and movies and, you know, short videos. And I mean, it's just, mm-hmm. I think it's changing, you know. I think in a few generations, that's how you'll be talking about literature.
Yeah.
Where, you know,
it makes me think of it makes me think of the references in Star Trek Deep Space Nine and Voyager to holo novels, right? The idea of like
right.
how the novel has changed, you know, it's you no longer
that's
just
right.
write a book, you know, it's now
that's right.
This,
Janeway
like,
was literally the governess
thing.
in
Jane Eyre, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was
Jane Eyre.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, just to think about the ways in which, you know, technology does change the parameters of, you know, interactive literature and stuff. It's
mm-hmm.
really interesting.
Really interesting.
But anyhow, yeah. That's cool.
But we're going to have a session like this, so I'm assuming, I mean, I have obviously never done one, but I think it'll be like this where people can put in comments and questions.
Yep,
and,
definitely.
I mean,
it'll be exactly like this.
I don't think I'll see him, but Sarah, who's my thesis advisor, will be talking to me, and she'll be seeing him moderating the questions.
Great. Absolutely. Okay, cool. So that's going to be a lot of fun. So I hope everyone will be able to join us at 2 p.m. on Sunday for that. One last thing, which I forgot to add to the announcements because it's so recent, I forgot that it existed, is we're having a session. Today is Friday. So tomorrow, Saturday the 18th at 11 a.m. Eastern time, I'm going to do a review and discussion of the Tolkien film. A lot of people have been wanting to talk about that since it came out. I've done sessions with Maggie Park, one of the Signum faculty, on the trailers as they have come out, as we've been sort of anticipating the Tolkien film. So she and I are going to get together again and do our reaction and discussion tomorrow. So hope you guys could make it for that. All of these things are on our events page, signumuniversity.org/event. You will be able to find registration links for my Tolkien discussion tomorrow, for Trish's Thesis Theater on Sunday, and of course for Mythmoot as well. All right, so let us move on. And our first creative challenge of the day is music commissions. All right. Any scenes, characters, or themes that need musical themes? For example, do we need a special theme for reconciliation, and when would it be used? So let me think about that. Okay. We've been talking about forgiveness and reconciliation, but of course it's not. Remember that the concept of the theme is, in a sense, not necessarily reconciliation itself, but like we're looking at the different options here, right? Some people will not reconcile. there are some people who, like, for whom reconciliation is like irrelevant, right? That they, you know, for them it's not even on the table. There are others who sort of fail at reconciliation. There are others that succeed at reconciliation. the need for reconciliation and the different ways in which people kind of respond to that is the sort of the larger theme. And like, do people, and you know, so we also talked about forgiveness, right? And that reconciliation and forgiveness are not necessarily the same thing. You can forgive someone without reconciling with them, and you can reconcile with them but not forgive them for what they did. So exploring the different concepts there. I like the idea of a musical theme being associated with this, and I'm trying to think. So, I mean, obviously, here I go, like, making suggestions that are kind of above my head. That is to say, I should be the last person who is saying to Philip Menzies has been our film composer since season one, and knows way more than I do about music and how to do this kind of thing. But of course, thinking about forgiveness and reconciliation, sort of harmony and disharmony, seems like an obvious kind of thing to do there. I would wonder if there would be some kind of like scale of harmony and dissonance that could be used. I'm not even sure if it's necessarily a particular theme, maybe like particular modes or something. I'm not quite sure. But I think it would be interesting if we had okay, so there's going to be moments in the season when we have this sort of impulse towards dissonance, right? This impulse towards fragmentation. Certainly, especially as Sauron and Thuringwethel get involved, right, and start spreading rumors and trying to undermine things. Remember, we were talking even just in last episode, or last session, we were talking about episodes 3 and 4. We were looking at Thingol and Melian becoming suspicious, right? Like, what's going on? You know, what is this darkness that is in Galadriel's past? You know, that is obviously really upsetting her. What's happening here? All those sort of chains of suspicion that we had, that we had been talking about. So when it would be interesting, I think, to have, as I say, some kind of spectrum, right, of whether it's done by dissonance and harmony, whether it's done by sort of the shifting of musical modes, or some kind of modulation of key, or even, Tony, as you suggest, maybe of time signature as well. I'm not sure exactly how it would map out best, but I do think it would be interesting to have this sort of spectrum with on the one end, right, on the dissonant end, you would have Sauron and Thuringwethel actively sowing seeds of discord, right? And then you would have, a little bit past that, you would have suspicion, right? When people are doubting and suspicious of others, and fighting, right? Also, like the conflict between Carinthir what's his name? Blanking. The guy we talked about last time, the whole time. Angrod, thank you. Yes.
I was going to say, don't look at me. That was 2 weeks ago.
I know. Anyway, yes. I'm like, that other son of Finarfin, whose name is eluding me at the moment. Angrod, yes. So again, when there's like open conflict as well. And then, you know, again, moving further up, you would get sort of like doubt and uneasiness, right? Which wouldn't be actual conflict or suspicion of another person. But this sort of unease, right? I was going to say unrest, but that's sort of more associated with season 3, and season 2, really. But I mean, like, that sort of like uncertainty, right? About like, what's going to happen? How are we going to work things out? Are we going to be able to work together? What's going on? And then we would have, like, again, continuing to move up, I guess, the spectrum. We would then have reconciliation, right? People actually reaching out and attempting to bridge gaps, and to join with each other. And then on the, like, the far end of the spectrum, right? The very opposite of the kind of active discord, you know, desire to create discord that we get from Sauron and Thorin Gwethil, we would get forgiveness, right? And people forgiving each other, we would deploy this presumably in with Galadriel forgiving herself, right? I mean, to me, I think one of the most beautiful moments of the whole season really should be, you know, one of the emotional climaxes of the whole season, I think, should be the moment when, you know, the conversation between Celeborn and Galadriel, when he, like, gets her to forgive herself, right? When he helps her to when he shows forgiveness to her and helps her to forgive herself. That's huge. And really, I think sort of emotionally maps onto the entire, onto the entire picture, or the whole, even the whole political picture, in Beleriand. So I don't know the mechanism for that, Phil, what exactly that would be, whether it's a particular theme that then gets sort of tampered with, whether it's a kind of formula of tampering that can be applied to other themes, right? Not really sure. Again, I kind of leave this to your musical judgment. What's the best way to accomplish that? But I think that there should be that kind of progression. It would be kind of cool, I think, if it were not a theme itself, but some kind of manipulation of themes, whether it be modal, whether it be, I'm not sure. Like I said, I don't know nearly enough to make that kind of a concrete suggestion.
I have a question, and it kind of goes to the next one too, I guess, with the Stark Loves. I mean, are we going to have, themes for characters? Like, is Galadriel going to have her own motif? Is Celeborn going to have his own motif? I mean, I see a problem with that, which is that there's enough significant characters in this story that we could end up with, like, hundreds of motifs.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It could end up sounding like a sound effects board, right? when somebody comes in. Yeah. Yeah. No.
Because, you know, like you were just saying with this reconciliation, I mean, Galadriel and Celeborn played into that. So, you know, if each of them had a theme, do they, you know, maybe there's like a limited number that we do that get, because like Galadriel and Celeborn, we're going to see throughout the whole thing.
Right.
You know,
I would say, so thinking about what we've done in the past, right? We did have particular themes associated with the different Valar, but the reason, the justification for that, clearly, I mean, you know, apart from the fact, like, they're the Valar, is that what the Valar stand for, like who they are, is sort of thematic, right? So the Yavanna theme that we established back in, I say we, that Phil established back in season one.
We'll expect to hear.
Right. At times when there is, you know, growth and so when the sun comes out and the flowers all bloom, clearly the Yavanna theme has to be playing, right? Similarly.
Oh, I know. When we meet Goldberry, that'll get the whole controversy going. When we meet Goldberry, play Yavanna's theme. Ooh.
Yeah, she's like, she would be like a blending of like, Olmo and, Yavanna.
Right. Yavanna. Yeah.
Absolutely.
No, I could see, I could definitely see that. I do wonder, like with Galad, I mean, I'm trying to think if there's anybody else that we see all the way through the Third Age at this point. There's not, is there? I mean, you know, Círdan, but he's off stage. So in the case of somebody like Galadriel and Celeborn, when Gandalf shows up, you know, there might be a need to do some kind of motif for those characters, but I would say we want to limit it. I would imagine.
Yeah.
Would agree.
And again, I was like, yeah, it's what I'm kind of building towards there is I do think we would want to do that only when there is, like, when we're associating a character with a particular idea or concept, right?
Because
again, like, that's what we did with all the Valar. I mean, we now have things that can be, you know, so when we play the Manway theme, when we play the Olmo theme, right? When we play the Aule theme, it means something. Like, there are particular associations with that, that can work in lots of places throughout the whole show.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that we could do something like that with the, and Ellen, you're absolutely right. Tom Bombadil needs a theme. Right? Absolutely need a Tom Bombadil theme.
And it needs to be in, what's the meter that he, that he talks in?
Oh, well, he's, yeah, I mean, he speaks in dactylic hexameter, but
There you go.
I'm not sure how you would render that exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's got to be compatible with his meter. You're right. I mean, it's how he talks.
Well, you know, and Ruth brings up, I mean, there's a lot of ways to slice and dice this. Like she's talking about maybe the regions, you know, is there a region? Yep. Do the Sindar have a theme? Do the, you know, Noldor have a theme? I mean, that's really interesting. I mean, this thing about the star-crossed lovers, I could totally see some kind of motif there that we hear with Galadriel Celeborn. We hear it even with Eol and Arathel in a different way. Mm-hmm. We hear it with Arwen and Aragorn, Beren and Lúthien, Eowyn and Aragorn. You know, it's like there's a lot of places where that theme of a, if we want to call it star-crossed or, you know, pairing theme could go. I mean, I could definitely see that as opposed to having like a Galadriel Celeborn. Or in this case, do we need a theme for our star-crossed lovers of Galadriel and Celeborn? Do you use the star-crossed theme with Galadriel's and Celeborn's motifs? I don't know. Like you say, I'm speaking way beyond where I really should be sitting. So
it's good for us to think about. When I come to think about like making specific, like here's how you should accomplish this in your composition, that's when I'm like getting way above myself. But yeah, I mean, I tend to think that it would be more fruitful for us to be thinking. I really love the and Phil started doing this last year with like his fall, you know, the fall theme. Well, I mean, fall theme was from before, but he started doing sort of more conceptual themes, right, rather than character oriented themes, and that seems to me the way to go. So like, if we do have, you know, if we do have like a, you know, a reconciliation and forgiveness theme, which can be, you know, can be sort of effect, so that theme can be played in a way which suggests like discord and suspicion, right? But it's just a modification of that central theme. I mean, that would be pretty cool if we had a theme which, like, when played aright, means forgiveness and like joining together, and but can be like altered until it's the, you know, and warped until it is the until it is the discord and suspicion theme. So as far as the kind of thinking of the ideas, that's certainly one idea. I'm not sure about. I'm not sure. So I'm thinking about Galadriel and Celeborn.
Love impeded is more. That's true of, you know, Beren and Lúthien, their love is impeded. You know, Arwen and Aragorn, love is impeded. I mean, it's more like, you know, love with lots of obstacles kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. The question I'm thinking about right now is, do we want a lover's theme? Because I'm thinking that might whitewash things a little too much, right? Like, do we need a, like, this is the theme of people who are in love, right?
You know, I mean, as opposed to, these are the theme of people who are killing other people.
Right. Right.
Let's have the last one, but not the first one.
Yeah, no, exactly. You can make an argument for, like, battle, like, when people are fighting in battle, like, I don't know. It's a little bit more uniform.
I would love to see some kind of a love theme that also then gets stylized. Like, for example, when Sam talks about Rosie, it's the love theme in a Hobbity kind of, rendition. With kazoos or something, you know?
Not with kazoos. I think there we're going way over our heads when we're suggesting instrumentation. But yeah.
I would like to see something because, I mean, we're in really dire times right now, you know, and there's still going to be a lot going forward. I mean, the Games of Thrones fans are going to love this because there's going to be blood and blood and blood and blood. It would be nice to have a little bit of a flower here and there, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we do have the flower theme. Now let's see, interesting. So Ellen is suggesting a revenge / kinslaying / doom theme related to the fall theme, that we had before.
A combination of bagpipes and vuvuzelas.
No, Phil, that's not how it goes. I mean, the idea of, Well, we have the fall theme. See, oaths are more complicated because, I don't know. I mean, Phil, it would be interesting to hear what you could come up with for, like, an oath swearing theme, right? Because it would be really nice to. One of the things that was that, of course, is so wonderful about having a really good soundtrack is that you can say things without having to say them, right? So rather than having, you know, giving characters hokey dialogue, which obviously our writers would never give to our characters, but rather than giving them a hokey dialogue like, well, you know, it looks like that oath that you took is coming back to bite you, isn't it? Right? Like, rather than having to remind, you know, our viewers of, like, the power of the oaths and everything, we just have an oath theme, right, which comes back. So, you know, when the oath theme plays down the road, when Finrod swears his oath, right, and then later on, when Beren comes to Nargothrond, right, the oath theme is again playing in the background. So, you know, that kind of thing is, I think, a really good idea. I really like that. Sorry, yes, Phil, I was speaking to Phil Boswell. We have two Phils. Philip Menzies is our composer. Phil Boswell is here commenting, and so when it is not Philip Menzies who is suggesting the bagpipes and vuvuzelas. yeah. Anyway, yeah, and Catherine, you're absolutely right. Differentiating, you know, having you know, themes which are then can be differentiated through instrumentation, right, is a really great idea. So, because I mean the theme, the theme that's playing during the Oath of Feanor, right, shouldn't sound exactly like the Oath of Finrod, because Finrod's oath, though it binds him and, you know, gets him in some trouble, is not a horrible thing. It's not this like terrible blasphemous vow like Feanor took. It's fundamentally different. Anyway, so yeah, I do think that there are ways in which that same theme can be adapted in various ways, and Phil Menzies is really good at this. Yeah, good. And Ellen is pointing out that same theme could be played sort of discordantly or harmoniously as well. Yeah, no, exactly. So I do like the idea of an oath theme. I think that would be a really good idea. We're obviously going to need a Footsteps of Doom theme when we get to Turin, right? So it might be good to begin working on that earlier rather than later, because the Footsteps of Doom are definitely going to be coming in at various points. I don't know if we would need to deploy that in this season or not, but certainly that would be kind of a fun thing if we could have an oath theme and that sort of doom theme. And between the fall theme, the doom theme, and the oath theme, right, we can certainly get at the Oath of Feanor, right, in that way too. Yeah, oh, good, Ellen, I agree with you. The Doom theme can be like the personal soundtrack of Emras, right? Who is very high on the way in which the Oath of Feanor has doomed them all. Yeah, no, absolutely, I like that. Anyhow, so I think that those things would be great. As back to the Galadriel and Celeborn question, though. I find myself resistant to a theme for their relationship, and the reason I am resistant to that is that their relationship is so centrally tied to the core theme of the season, the reconciliation and forgiveness theme, right? That I would want the music playing in their scenes to be really tied with that. I think that the scene which probably culminates in their betrothal, right? Is going to be the sort of purest and most beautiful instance of forgiveness in the entire season. So that's really the place where, I mean, if we have a different, you know, lovey romance theme for them, then it could displace the central forgiveness concept, which I think would be really, really cool. Anyway, so yeah, so let's, so I wouldn't necessarily want to do that though. Trish, back to the point that you made, Galadriel, obviously she, I think she kind of does merit her own theme in some way, or maybe her own unique instrumentation, some kind of thing, some kind of musical signature of some kind or other, whether it be a separate theme, whether it be an instrumentation choice, something about it. I agree. There should be a distinct kind of Galadriel flavor that we would probably want to create. Think about how useful that will be when we get to the Return of the King, right? And, and Sam's rope and all, there's so many scenes when, the Galadriel theme, which we could then combine with, like, the Elbereth theme, right? Yeah, that would be super helpful.
Are you saying you don't think poor Celeborn should have his own theme? Poor Celeborn.
Look, you can't say we're not doing justice to Celeborn in this season, right? Celeborn has never gotten such a spotlight as we're giving him here. We're giving Celeborn more credit than anyone in the history of Celeborn.
We can start off with Celeborn having his own theme, but over the years it like shifts more and more into Galadriel's theme. So by the time we meet him in the Third Age in Lothlorien, you don't even notice his theme anymore, and it's all Galadriel, right?
Yeah. Celeborn's theme gets subsumed in the Galadriel theme. It becomes merely an echo of the Galadriel theme.
Exactly. That would be true to people's opinions of him when they meet him in the Third Age.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Emphasis is on thematic versus character leitmotifs, it sounds like, is what Marie's saying. I think that's accurate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I definitely agree. Phil Boswell has a really interesting point. He was anticipating a theme played for Lilith, Turin's sister, to kind of tie that in, thinking in advance of some of these major themes that are going to be a part of these central stories later on, right? It would be fun to think about how the Lilith theme can kind of play through, both to anticipate Lilith and to also, echo Lilith. So I don't know. Do we need a transient period of laughter and happiness theme? Basically, is how I would define it. Yes. Laughter and joy, which fades all too soon, right? Is that a theme we can get? And Marie, it would be connected with mortality. Well, mortality, obviously, that's a theme for the next season, right? The season 5 issue is going to be thinking about mortality and stuff, and that certainly we will definitely want a mortal death theme. Right, that's definitely a thing that is going to be a major concern. Back to Philip's other question. What style of music would we like for the Mareth Adarthad? Not soundtrack. Like, what music will Elvish minstrels play at the Mareth Adarthad? Because presumably there's going to be music and dancing at the Mareth Adarthad, right? And he says he had in mind an 18th century ball and Baroque style music. On the other hand, we may want to set the tone for other feasts that will happen and introduce the mystery of fairy, which we've not really done up to this point. Well, one of the challenges with the mystery of fairy is that we don't have anybody but fairies around, right? I mean, the mystery of fairy really becomes a thing when humans come in. In fact, it's almost like a parallel to the language thing, right? As long as everyone's talking the same language, we have them all talking English. It's only when they encounter somebody else speaking a different language that we realize they were speaking Elvish at all, right? Similarly, these are all elves. They're all fairies, right? And so all of them are. So it's like normal. It's only when humans come in that we're like, oh, whoa, these are elves, right? It depends on what we mean by it. I do I wouldn't want it to be straight up 18th century ball. Like, not just like exactly like 18th century ball. There does have to be something, sort of fairy in it. But at the same time, I wouldn't think that the Noldor wouldn't. I mean, I would think the Noldor would go for very highly technical music. Don't you think? I mean, I don't think that, the Noldor just do Enya. I wouldn't think that would be the case.
It'd be fun if the Noldor were more like big band sound. It would be like just not. It would be so unusual, right?
It would be very unusual, yeah.
Because I was thinking percussion. You know, a lot of times we limit percussion to like the bad guys or to moments of conflict and stuff. And I was trying to think, you know, what could the Noldor have that's like not, you know, would be kind of out of the box in terms of its sort of like type of music. Oops, sorry about that. That's not the bird, actually.
Oh, that's not the bird. I was going to say I thought that was Buddha in the background. Yeah.
My microwave.
Buddha does such a convincing microwave beat impersonation. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, I was thinking it would be fun to something out of the box, you know. I think and Ellen's saying she thinks Noldor and Sindarin both have some kind of percussion aspect to their music. Anyway.
Yeah, but no, I mean, I do like, because you're right. We don't want to restrict drums to the bad guys. Yeah, I don't know. I guess again, I don't want to.
There's a Canadian artist by the name of Lorena McKennett, which I would imagine Phil probably is aware of. Her band is a really interesting mix of instruments from, you know, lots of different cultures, and her kind of music is kind of interesting because there's kind of a little bit of a tradition to it, but there's also like a different interpretation of it. So something mm-hmm. like that would be kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. I feel like as soon as I start suggesting musical styles or things, I'm in way over my head. Like, you know, many people know so much more about music than I do that, like, I'm not even going to make a suggestion. I do like the idea of a more formality. That is, I would think that both the music and the dancing of the Noldor would tend towards the ornate, intricate, and highly structured, right? And so in that way, I find Baroque-style music, like the idea of Baroque-style music and 18th century ball dancing seems to me right. Especially, you know, think about the way in which 18th century ball dancing involves like groups of people all moving in and out of each other. Now it's in fairly simple ways. Like now we put our hands up and we walk around in a circle. Whereas I would think the Noldor would be much more intricate than that. I'm sort of imagining the, like the dance floor at a Noldor do, right, would be this sort of amazing interconnection of people doing very intricate,
so punchy this morning, but I have to say, you know, like I was thinking about what you were just saying about you put your hands up and you walk in a circle, and you know how they show like in the movies or whatever, they, you know, the partners come apart and they come back together and they converse.
Yes.
So I was thinking of a scene where they're dancing, and you know, the Noldor are much more fancy. What they do is when they part, the guy does like a triple backflip.
I don't know that it would be athletic, though. See, that's, I mean, it could be. There could be athleticism involved. I just mean intricacy of movement in and out and among all the rest of them.
Right.
Yeah. Not necessarily athleticism. Though, I mean, again, it's not like that would be totally inappropriate. But anyway, yeah. So, I have no objection to athleticism, Phil. That's Phil Boswell. That sounds fine. But definitely formal dance moves. I mean, there's no way that the Noldor would just be like expressing their personality, right, through their like idiosyncratic movements. Like, I don't see, potentially.
Sindar is more the big band type group as opposed to the Noldor. Yeah.
Maybe
Noldor,
I don't
like,
know. I mean, potential again. Like, I'm not even gonna mention styles because, like, what do I know? And many people know better. So I'm trying to kind of restrict myself to general principles.
Yeah, Sindar was more like that. I do think a definite contrast between the two is important.
Yes.
However we do it, you definitely want to make it clear that they're like very different.
Yes, agreed that they are very different. And Ellen is right. It is Sindar who are more associated with music than Noldor. I mean, remember the music was much more strongly associated with the Teleri, right? And they're related. So, like singing and piping and music, like that's mostly a Sindar thing.
And I don't think that's
Maglor's the exception.
What you just said about the Noldor being very, you know, precise and very stiff, almost stiff. You didn't say stiff. I said stiff. But, I mean, I keep thinking of, like, very, you know, like, harpsichord type.
Well, I would say structured, you know, not stiff. I would say structured.
Stuff.
Yes.
That's it.
Structured. Yeah.
But
and
still
yet,
not as expressive at all as what the Sindar would be when you see.
Yes. And I agree with Marie that the Green Elves would be on the far end of the spectrum, right?
Yeah.
So we'd have the Noldor on one side.
They'd be like, you know, rock and roll. They'd be like, you know. In my metaphor.
Yeah. They would be much more spontaneous. Maximally spontaneous, I think. Yes, exactly. Good. Now, Tony points out, of course,
Quindy would do all improv, so it'd be like jazz.
Right. Exactly. Tony points reminds us that the Noldor would be more associated with singing and words. Actually, I would say even more. So I would actually associate, not that we're getting much Vanyar music, certainly in this season, but I'm thinking the Vanyar would actually be the most linguistic of all of the, so the Vanyar, obviously the Vanyar rap, clearly, like that's obviously what happens.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
They probably have poetry slams and everything, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Clearly. Yeah. No, not beat poets, Phil. No, they would be rappers. Rap, the ultimate linguistic genre. Oh, my heart. Sorry, I love rap music. Rap music is...
You know, there's also the idea of chanting. You know, there could be chanting of some kind.
Could be chanting, but there needs to be, like, the play and beauty of words.
Yes.
Not of music, but of words themselves.
Yeah.
That's why rap. Rap is the one that's all about the actual sound of words and making music with the sound and interplay of words itself, independent of actual tone, right? Actual music. See, now, Tony, not Gregorian chant. I think Gregorian chant is actually exactly the opposite of what I'm talking about. Gregorian chant, the words are practically irrelevant. You can't understand the words at all. It's just tone, right? No, the music of words is about the interplay of words themselves, right? I'm telling you. Rappers are the only people that I know who actually accomplish this in its pure form. It's the best. Anyway. But anyhow, okay, so Elvish hip hop and I would be lying if I told you I hadn't actually thought about that. But anyhow, I'm going to start digressing and talking about Eminem soon if I'm not careful. So I'm going to divert from that. All I'm going to say is at Mithmoot this year, I'm planning to give a talk on rap music. So
I'm
completely
great.
Serious. I'm going to be doing a detailed analysis of Eminem. So
goodness.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I was going to say our little writing team could have a splinter group, right? Who
goes on. Oh, man, I'm telling you. I would love to collaborate with somebody on like a I have this sort of hyper fantasy, like fantasy in the sense of like, you know, with zero a chance of ever like actually accomplishing it. I would love to have a like Silmarillion rap album in the style of Eminem. Oh man, it would be
wow.
The best. I would absolutely
Marie
love that.
Marie has helped perform the rap battle between Finrod and Sauron. Oh my goodness, Marie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that absolutely should have that. I purest form. Purest form. I'm telling you, it is not. Yeah.
Maybe that's how Luthien puts Morgoth to sleep.
No, see, Luthien, I don't think so. With Luthien, it's about music. I'm not trying to undermine the power of music. I'm just saying, like whenever I'm listening to rap music, I'm thinking about that line from the Valaquenta about Manwë and the music of words.
Interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, exactly. Tony, I agree. With Luthien, it would be pure melody. And Marie, I also agree that Luthien is sort of dancer first, singer second. I think that's true. I mean, I think singing is also very important for her. But yeah, that whole thing, it's not rap, definitely not Luthien's thing. but again, I think the Vanyar would
definitely
be all bad. Over it. All over it. But now we've managed heartily to digress from our series of digressions here. So
we did it. I love it. Yes.
That's good. Anyhow, setting the tone for other feasts that happen.
Just thinking about that. Because, you know, we're going to definitely have that. Immediately, I thought of the woods in Mirkwood.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, of course, we're going to get a series of very important feasts. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's think for a second in broader terms. We're thinking specifically about the musical style and the dancing at the Marathodarthod, but first of all, like, we're taking for granted that they're getting together and having that, like, singing and dancing is a thing that they do. I'm not challenging that, but we should probably back up a step and say, okay, gathering of elves. Right? Big ol' elf party at the Marathodarthod. What's an elf party like? You know, when you're bringing together lots of elves into one place for purposes of merriment and celebrating, what do they do? What happens?
There would be a bouncy house.
There would be a bouncy castle. Could you imagine the Noldoran bouncy castle? Holy cow. Yeah. Ooh, Ellen, what a wonderful question. Alcohol? Did they get drunk?
I think so.
Do any of the elves get completely soused? Do a bunch of the elves get completely soused? Is that a thing that happens at elf gatherings?
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
I could definitely see having some alcohol-fueled, you know, arguments/fights.
One thing I am very firm on is that I certainly refuse to kowtow to the really, to me, bizarre Peter Jackson elves don't get drunk thing. Like, I never got that at all. I always thought that was stupid.
In The Hobbit, like Ellen even pointed out, I mean, the guy gets drunk.
I know. It's like crucial to the plot of The Hobbit that you can get elves drunk. I've never gotten that, and it's, you know, it's become, fortunately, it's not quite so firmly rooted as some of the other associations with elves and hobbits and things like that. I think, for instance, like the connection between hobbits and meals is actually a little bit exaggerated in the popular, you know, associations with it. Again, I'm not saying it's not there in the text, but it's a little exaggerated, I think.
Bilbo was thinking about bacon almost constantly throughout his trip.
It's true. I'm not saying it isn't there. I'm just saying that I think it's a little bit exaggerated, as if hobbits were like all about food. Like, they're not all, they're about other things in addition to food. But anyway, whatever. The point is, it's not like the whole elves don't get drunk thing hasn't taken quite as deep root as the seven meals a day thing for hobbits has taken root in the kind of general, you know, Tolkien consuming world. So I think it won't be too hard to fight back against the elves don't get drunk thing.
I can also see Maria's suggestion of mead as being the alcoholic drink that they drink.
Quicker to make.
Did they have alcohol on Valinor, by the way? Something they could have brought with them, like the bees and
I'm just imagining them hauling casks of wine across the Helcaraxa. But yeah, no, sure. Absolutely.
I meant the tradition of making.
The tradition of making. You're right. Yeah.
Right. They would have brought it with them.
Right. Or like beehives. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Get all the Olmo.
Yeah.
Yeah, beer and meat. That's what Ellen is pointing out. She's right. You know, climate wise, you'd need to have something that is so beer, mead. Berry wine, but not grape wine.
Yes. Grape wine can
be in the forefront. It could certainly be in the background in the sense of what exactly it is. But
right.
Somebody drunk would be fun.
Right.
Let's get Celeborn drunk.
You know, actually, I really kind of like, again, it's one of those things, right? Like dwarves drink beer and elves drink wine, right? There's another thing,
right?
That is kind of a kind of a cliche in, having the elves being drinking mead and beer, would be,
out of the horns of animals, you know, like the Vikings. Perfect. Let's break as many stereotypes as we can. I like it.
Absolutely. Oh, wait. Maria's reminding us that they showed the Valar making mead from honey at Tolkas and Nessa's wedding.
Right.
Okay. Look, I forgot about what they were drinking at Tolkas and Nessa's wedding.
So good we're having Marie here. She
absolutely. Yes. I'm so glad there's somebody who doesn't forget things as quickly as we do.
I know.
Let's see.
Oh, yeah. And Ellen, absolutely. They're goblets. I mean, you know, the Noldor would be all about.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
like,
absolutely.
Pomp and circumstance, even with regard to drinking stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Jeweled goblets and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to have an elf sommelier.
So drinking. We've established there's drinking at the gathering. But what else do they do? You're a bunch of elves. What do you do for fun? Music. I think music and dancing that's fine. Anything else? Do they do anything else?
God, that's a really good point. Because these are not people that, I mean, these are people that see each other all the time, right?
Well.
And they live a very long time.
They live a very long time and they don't,
it's kind of like, you know, what are you going to chit-chat about?
Well, I mean, they have stuff they can chit-chat about, but Tony, I was thinking about that too, and Ellen as well. Storytelling, right? Speeches and storytelling.
What about play acting? Do you think there'd be any kind of play acting? Like, with stories? Do you think there'd be, like, amateur theatrics?
Yeah.
Sort of a la Victorian era?
Amateur theatrics, probably much better than in the amateur theatrics in the Victorian era. theatrics. I'm thinking about Tolkien's, you know, the thing that comes to mind, Trish, when you raise the issue of dramatics, is Tolkien's references to fairy and drama, right? That, like, enchantment is what they do. So, but goodness, how could you convey this? Like, elvish storytelling, right? So I'm imagining story, like, in the storytelling part, right, there would be people, but it's not just like somebody sitting in a chair telling a story, right? It would be when one of the elf lords, right, to use the Fellowship of the Ring phrase that we've been talking about a bit lately, when an elf lord tells a story, you're there, right? I mean, you're enchanted into that story. So elf stories are holo novels, to bring it back to Star Trek Voyager. No, seriously, like you find yourself there, right? So it would be kind of hard to sort of show on screen people being kind of transformed into... Marie was thinking the same thing, like how you're kind of enchanted into the live story. You're not just hearing a story when an elf is telling you a story, right? So I don't think they would need dramatic, you know, like to need drama, need stagecraft, right? Because the enchantment that elves could bring about is, I mean, Tolkien brought up that concept as like that it is the ultimate, like stagecraft is merely an attempt through clumsy human ways to do that kind of thing, right? To bring you into the story, like you're seeing it unfold in front of your eyes, but you, the viewer, have to invest a great deal of yourself, right? A great deal of your own imagination into, you know, believing that what is happening on stage is exactly, you know, is happening in front of you. Elves don't need that. So I don't think they would do it in that way.
That's really interesting, you know, because we have the opportunity to show that when we introduce the humans, you know.
Yes.
I mean, over time, the difference between that, you know, and kind of reflect that observation of Tolkien in this story.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, people can think about what that looks like. Nick wants it to be done through the smoke of the fires. Not sure I'm picturing what you're talking about, Nick. Not sure I can see it, but it might be cool. The fact that I can't.
That could be a precursor, isn't it? Frodo in the Hall of Fire, right? When he's listening to the story and he has the same experience of being carried away into the story.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well. Not sure what kind of techniques we might want. And of course, it's not like we're going to necessarily feature it heavily. I mean, presumably it would be something that would be happening on the side. We would just sort of show that it's happening on the side.
Right.
Unless we take up Tony's suggestion, which is, you know, he says this could be our chance to really see what happened to Fingon, Mithros, and the Eagles.
That's a really good idea, actually.
Yeah.
Fingon
tells the story of the...
Yeah, we're not really heavy on flashback type stuff, but this is a great way to kind of do it. It's flashback, but it's woven into the story. I mean, it's part of you know?
Right. Die Ruin on the Twitch chat was just saying, you know, was thinking of the Mirror of Galadriel, right? You know, is there any kind of instrument like that or similar kind of enchantment like that used to show or to tell stories? The thing about the Mirror of Galadriel is that it is kind of a window into, like, things that could happen or things that will happen. It's not exactly... She says she's not in control of it, right? So it's not exactly a sort of a storytelling device. But nevertheless, I do like that idea of... an instrument, like again, that seems like a fairly Noldoran thing, right? To be like, I have, you know, developed this thing. The somebody using water or a pool of water in some ways like this would be kind of cool. Anyway, I don't know. Now, Sharon asks a great question. Would they necessarily be engaged in a single large group or in smaller clusters? I would think in smaller clusters, right? There might be some special things, like, so for instance, if, I don't know, I mean, I could imagine there being a sort of a more, a big central thing, but probably not for storytelling. I mean, I would think that different, you know, people would tell different stories.
Storytelling.
Would there be competition? Would they compete?
You know, I mean, like a formal competition, like they have, you know, like.
I would think they would probably compete. Ellen, do we get the Dairon and Maglor, you know, musical duel, right? You know, who is going to be named the greatest minstrel ever, right? Like the, you know.
Yeah, like the Canterbury Tales. I like that, Tony. I like that.
Yeah.
Person.
Yeah.
And the winner gets an all expense paid trip to the Greyhaven. Yay!
Yeah. Bragging rights for all time. Yeah. Yeah, storytelling definitely. You would think that would also be, I mean, again, it's the Noldo, right? They would be making stuff. They would have made stuff. They would be displaying stuff, right? So, I mean, surely, whether it's only in their own, clearly the costumes of the Noldor would have to be at their maximally elaborate that we ever show them in Middle Earth, would be like how the Noldor gussy themselves up for a thing like this. So yes, there should be lots of display and appreciation, right, by others of the things that have been made, right, the works of hands in various ways. Certainly the visual distinction between how the Noldor dress and how the Sindar dress should never be more visible than at the Marath Adarthad, I would think. Good. So back to the topic which I skipped over before of athletic competition. So there have been a couple votes for athletic competitions. That seems reasonable. What would they do? What would they do for athletic competitions? I mean, some of the classic things that are classics for a reason, right? Like running and jumping, you know, so like, you know, sprints and,
Well, archery would be one too, right?
Maybe.
I mean, that's kind of like so stereotypically elf.
Shot but it put. Is.
No, that's a dwarf thing. That should be a dwarf thing.
No, it shouldn't. No, it really shouldn't. No, I don't think so.
Endurance dancing.
Horseback, yeah. Horseback.
Well, and there would be the various and sundry types of things you can do on horseback. You know, like jousting knights do, you know, the...
Yeah.
You know, a target from horseback and...
Like that kind of gymnastics, right? I mean, like, yeah. General gymnastics, I think, would be something.
And this is... I'm kind of serious about this, like a parkour kind of course. You know, like... And we wouldn't, of course, call it parkour, but it would be, you know, like a... Or I could even see elves doing something like a triathlon or... You know, Iron Man type stuff.
On Twitch, Princess Ostrich asks the excellent question, are there elven martial arts?
Ooh.
And this is something I've thought about.
Being a martial artist.
Being a martial artist, I really enjoy martial arts. I don't know what place there is for, like, you know, unarmed combat. And unarmed combat techniques, and if this is a thing that we would have,
with nunchucks.
Yeah, see, Elle and I agree. I don't see the Noldor doing unarmed combat because they're too interested in, you know, like making weapons, right? So they would use weapons and armor.
I can see the green elves being more martial art types. You know what I'm saying?
Yes,
I
mean, though they're the ones who are primarily associated with archery too.
That's true. Yeah. But hey, you know, you get caught without your bow, or you run out of arrows. You know, you got to do. I mean, it's not like Legolas who always has arrows.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fencing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. You know, if we came up with some sort of, like, Olympic-ish elf thing, I mean, where are we going to put that, and how is that going to be part of a story? I suppose it could be a background kind of thing, but
yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, any of the things that we're talking about at the Marathatterthon here, I don't know to what extent any of it appears on screen, right? Yeah. It's good to think about just because we might want to, you know, when we're coming to the plot of the Marathatterthon, we might want to be interacting with some of these things at some point. It might just be in the background. I mean, so like, for instance, if we had someone telling a story and then we showed Galadriel walking away from it, right? So she's there in the crowd and then Galadriel walks away and that's when she and Celeborn have their conversation or something like that, right? I can imagine it coming up like that or even just happening in the background, like, you know, they're walking and in the background we're seeing, you know, like people doing like, you know, gymnastics on horseback or whatever it is they're doing, right? To see that happening in the background.
This is a pretty big celebration. So, I mean, it would need to be, you know, even if it's just visual, you know, obviously a huge celebration, you know, lots of things going on. I mean, they're also up against the Mountains of Shadow. There could be mountain type things going on if you want to talk about
climbing. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Somebody had suggested, and I didn't talk about it at the time, fireworks. Why not?
Ah, interesting.
There could be fireworks or something like fireworks.
Absolutely. You know, thinking about this, because this is a feast where they have ambassadors coming from all the different elf factions and whatnot, right? Back to the music again. You know, are we going to have music motifs for the different elf factions? And this would be a place where that music would play out.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, we certainly would have opportunities for that kind of thing.
See how I did that? Respect to music?
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Except I'm going to carry on digressing. So fireworks. I agree. Maria, I was thinking along the same lines. We do need to be, like, does this mean they have gunpowder? No, it doesn't mean they have gunpowder. I'm not convinced there's any gunpowder at all involved in Gandalf's fireworks, by the way, right? I mean, what evidence is there that Gandalf uses gunpowder? I mean, his magic is primarily interested in smoke and lights. That's what fireworks are, right? Smoke, lights, and noises. I don't know that there is any physical explosion involved in Gandalf's fireworks. I don't know what's in Gandalf's fireworks, but again, I am not necessarily assuming that it's gunpowder.
Are we sure we don't want to make fireworks specifically a Gandalf thing? Like, it's not been seen in Middle-earth until he shows up? I mean, otherwise, where do they get it from? It seems like there's need to be a backstory about where the fireworks come from. This would be the first time we would have seen them. Unless we have them in Valinor before, you know.
It might be... Well, you could do it one of two ways, right? We could choose either to have the Noldor doing fireworks here at the Marathatterthad and then have them not seen again until Gandalf revives them, right? Mm-hmm. So that when we see Gandalf setting off fireworks in the Shire, we are seeing, you know, this sort of comparatively modern and certainly comparatively modest culture being brought back into touch with some of the magic of the ancient world, right? That's one way in which we could play it. Or we could associate them specifically with Gandalf, right? Have Gandalf be the one who, like, it is his particular character which leads him to take this kind of magic with light and fire and smoke and turn it into this form of party entertainment which no one before him had ever thought of doing. Like, it seems also
like
a legitimate
idea,
way
frankly.
To do it.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a terrible thing for me to say, but I would love to reach back into an earlier, you know, season and actually show him kind of messing around with it, because we do have him in the story in Valinor, right?
Yeah.
And he's kind of like, it would be kind of cute if it was like you come across him and he's like doing this thing that just keeps bombing, you know, he can't quite get it to work, you know, I've got this good idea but I can't get it to work kind of thing, and then you just don't even refer to it anymore, and then, you know, then Gandalf shows up. But I my personal preference, although I will certainly go with the flow here, would be to have it be a Gandalf thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the other thing is, how do we explain them coming up with fireworks all of a sudden, where it's never really been even a thing before.
Who? Hobbits or Noldor? Noldor. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, but they're very inventive folk, right? So, you know.
I like it being a Gandalf thing, personally, but. You know.
What I like about that most, I think, is the way in which, like, the kind of spirit, not only spirit of fun in general, but sort of the spirit of community fun. I think it would be cool to associate that particular with Gandalf, and the kind of, there's the humility of it, right? The humility of, I'm going to take my gifts, especially Ellen, I agree with you, if he's using the Ring of Fire. Right, if he's using the Ring of Power in order to do fireworks displays for Hobbit children, like, that's that's like twice as cool.
It's like, wow, this ring Círdan gave me. Look what I can do with it.
Exactly, this is awesome. Fireworks displays for everybody now. That is sweet. I got an awesome Ring of Fireworks.
But it would be cool if at the Marith Adderfed, if there was some kind of light something. You know, do they have candles? I don't know if they have candles. Do they light faggots of wood, you know, and have them as torches and do something like a procession or, you know what I mean? Do something that would be really wonderful with light.
Right.
Or maybe they have some kind of fancy lantern system that they brought, you know,
wouldn't there be, if you could do the whole Faerian drama thing, right? If you could enchant your audience so as to make them see and hear things that are not physically present in front of them, wouldn't you also take advantage of this as a purely visual artist, right? Instead of merely painting on a canvas with paint, wouldn't you create, like, incredible, like, you know, intricate, moving, you know, paintings and images and things? Like, wouldn't that be one of the arts that you would do? And whether there was actually, I mean, whether this was a sort of like display or enchantment of actual light, or whether it was like something merely projected into the minds of your viewers, you know, through elvish enchantment, I would kind of think that this would be that would be a kind of thing, right? That they would do. That visual art to them would mean much more. They would have more resources for art than we do. Again, like just as stage drama is sort of a comparatively pitiful human imitation of the kind of things that the Noldor, you know, that elves can accomplish in storytelling, I would think that painting and sculpture would similarly be, you know, limited human approximations of what elves are capable of doing. And whether the art is purely holographic or whether there is a physical element as well, maybe there are actual things that are created or that have some function. Maybe there is an actual visible sort of light display that's also connected with it. I don't know. Yeah, no, I'm not saying that there wouldn't be physical sculptures and things also made. Oh, and I agree. There's certainly a place for that. I'm just saying I can't imagine, given the way that Tolkien describes elvish enchantment, it's hard for me to imagine that elvish art would be limited to that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we would see it, you know, like when the men come, we see that art stepping back into the art as we know it, you know, the two-dimensional, the flat, not moving kind of stuff, where the elves would never have that. They wouldn't even have that restriction.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I would think.
I want to go to this party. This party sounds.
This is starting to sound like a better and better party, isn't it?
Yeah.
And also, someone, Bell Durnick in the Twitch chat ages ago had suggested food. Obviously, right? Like some of the Noldor also are going to specialize in food, right? So certainly the kind of the cookery involved at the Marith Adderthad should be exceptionally elaborate, right? Definitely. Very elaborate. Wait, food.
Is there such a thing as fat elves?
Uh,
I would assume not, but...
Well, one of the things to keep in mind is that I mean, there aren't so many fat people in pre-industrial society.
That's true. Yeah.
I mean,
it doesn't really
again,
come up as an issue, does it?
Yeah. Not so often. Again, never, right? But not so often.
I guess we would have like burly. You know, there's like burly. You could have a burly elf, I suppose, like a Tolkas kind of elf, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're not all lithe and thin and.
Yeah.
You know, prancy but fierce type.
Good, yeah. Maria's reminding us of Salgant, Lord of Gondolin, who's called out as being overweight. I certainly would not say that it would be impossible for, like, that elves are immune to obesity any more than they're immune to drunkenness. Like, I would certainly think it possible.
Probably not usual, I would imagine.
No. No, I would think not usual or common. And I agree, Ellen says that she thinks the Lost Tales version of Salgunt is too silly and needs to be toned down. Well, yes, and of course, remember, like, fat is funny in Tolkien 95% of the time, right? I mean, seriously, how often is obesity not comic relief in Tolkien? Like, very rarely. Very rarely. That's not to say that that fat people in Tolkien are always made a mockery of, right? Like, for instance, Forlong the Fat is right. not mocked for being fat, exactly. But the fact that he is fat is, like, old Forlong the Fat, says Bergil, and it's clearly an affectionate... Like, the tone of that seems clearly affectionately teasing, right? So, like, fun is being made with him, even, you know, not to his face, because he's fat. He's not ridiculed. He's not being ridiculed for being fat, right? He's not being made a mockery of. And yet, it's funny. Like, it's still always funny.
Well, you know, like in Latin society, I'm specifically thinking Spanish, but I would imagine this is probably true in Italian, too. You know, they... Flaco and gordo, you know, flaco means skinny and gordo means fat. I mean, mm-hmm. they're nicknames.
Right.
And they're not meant to be pejorative at all. They're just, you know, it's like, it's just a nickname for a buddy of yours and who happens to be portly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well,
I was just wondering, I mean, you know.
It's a good question.
Do we show that, you know, in terms of our extras and whatnot, you know, it wouldn't be a big issue. It's just... You know, it'd be interesting to see some diversity of size, maybe, in our groups.
There should definitely be some. I agree.
And some short elves, now that we're talking about diversity. It could be shorter and taller ones, right? They're not all...
No, they're not all the same height, certainly. Yeah. Yeah. No, I do agree, Murray. We certainly don't want to... faithfully recreate Tolkien's penchant for making fat jokes every time obesity comes up.
Well, I guess what I'm thinking about here is, and I mean, we'll definitely do it with the humans. I was just wondering if we do it with the elves. You know, I mean, we have actually a commitment to diversity in many forms. You know,
we do.
Color and gender and whatnot. I just don't know with the elves. I how far do we go with this standard perception of, you know, the higher an elf is, the taller and skinnier the elf is. And the more points at their ears, right? I mean,
right. Right. Yeah.
Anyway, again, a digression, but it's something for us to maybe just think about how, what's our, you know, how are we going to do that?
I mean, it's a great question.
I think it would be fun to do a little bit of a different take on elves than what we've been handed down over, you know, by tradition.
Well, especially since so much of that is not textual, right? I mean, so much of that
is
associations that have been made. I was just talking about this the other day in exploring the Lord of the Rings. I think it was there, where people, you know, like the fact that people so often, like you'll hear people speak as if they assume all elves must be vegetarians. Like, oh, elves are right. Like at one with nature, so they would never kill living creatures. Yeah, they do all the time. They hunt like for fun. That's like they do that. We know for a fact they are not vegetarians, right? So, but again, people kind of will get this idea and sort of run with it. And also, as you say, kind of iron over any possibilities of cultural or even personal differences, right, mm-hmm, among elves. And that is certainly something that we need to be wary of. Just submitting to casually, you know, to the kind of to mere stereotypes of elves, which often sometimes are contradicted by the text, and even when they're not, are often not there. You know, something that we're merely projecting onto the text.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so, Ellen, I was thinking about that, too. Let's take that fat elves discussion one step further, because I think this is exactly the good question. So, Ellen was saying, you know, basically asking, are overweight elves consistent with the concept of elves being immune to disease and having this kind of spiritual control over their body, right? I mean, the relationship between elves and their bodies is just not the same as humans. So you're unlikely to find elves just like getting a little stout around the middle, right? Because they haven't been watching their diets lately. I agree. I'm not sure elves would necessarily work that way physiologically.
I think it's more the way they're born as opposed to being a reflection of body
perhaps.
Habits. I mean, where did we say that spiritual control over bodily urges necessarily means being skinny?
Especially, you know? If, like, because there's spiritual control and then there's spiritual control, right? Someone who has spiritual control would arguably not, like, slay their kin, for instance, right? If they fall into that particular kind of spiritual weakness, wouldn't they also fall into other forms of spiritual weakness?
That's a good point. That is actually a good point. That's a very interesting.
So,
although I certainly don't want to like necessarily have us be equating body fat with,
well, that's it. I mean,
you know, erosion of morals or something like that.
Right, exactly. But yeah, no, I mean, it's,
I've always thought of Finway as being kind of a burly elf, you know, like, you know, solid man. I mean, it could be a line thing, you know, like the line of so-and-so tends to be more meaty than the line of this other, you know what I mean? It doesn't necessarily, I don't think it has to necessarily even be personal. It's just that some tend to be heavier than others. And it's not a, you know, he drank too much beer and now has a beer gut. That's not what I'm talking about at all.
Right, right, right. Exactly.
I'm just talking about diversity in body, in morphology, I guess.
Right, really. In morphology. Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, there certainly needs to be diverse. And again, there also, you get this sort of like stereotype of elvish build, right? That all elves are, you know, wispy and slight, and there can be, there certainly should be elves who are built like NFL linebackers, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
Like, who was just saying, Tony said, Bellic, he's always thought of Bellic and Mablung as being bigger and burlier. And Marie says it really well. The idea is to have a variety of body types without it being that the handful of fat elves are weak or objects of mockery. It's just
yes.
A thing. It's just...
Yes.
That's just the reality. There's some that are thinny. And some that are fat.
Right. There you go.
Anyway.
Yeah, yeah. yeah, now, Tony was asking, what food is served at the Mareth Adarthad? Well, meat. They can have meat. They can have pastries. And Tony, not Tony, Nick, I love the suggestion that Caranthir's real gift is he's the pastry chef, right? That's talk about, I was going to say that would really be running contrary to type for Caranthir, except that I withdraw that suggestion because I've known too many pastry chefs. It's not actually that contrary to
really
type. So no.
It's like a county fair, right? And have like a bake off.
Yeah, no. The majority of pastry chefs I've known have been really cranky, actually. So
oh, really?
You know, I actually
totally in character.
Exactly. But anyway,
You know,
fruits,
pastries,
sure.
Are they agricultural? I mean, they have to get flour to make pastries, right?
Yeah.
Are they grinding flour? And I mean,
they have to.
We've already kind of talked about that, haven't we? That there's going to be some kind of farming going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to.
Lots of fruits.
Yeah. Lots of fruits and vegetables and pies and. Yeah.
Is it sit down or is it more buffet style? In other words, are we going to have serving people or are we going to have it just, there's just tables of food and people are picking up what they
I think
want.
Tables of food. I don't think we're going to have like,
I don't think we're going to have the servant class thing going.
No, yeah. And I don't think we're going to have like show a bunch of Noldor sitting around and being like, would table 17 now come to the buffet table? Like, I don't think we're going to have that. So, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, they would certainly grow grain, and I think they've been. Remember, one of the beauties of season 4 is that we make an indefinite amount of time pass between almost every episode. Like I don't think we ever really need to be clear, but it can easily be more than 1 year. I mean, that by episode 5, easily, right? And that's where we're doing the Marathatterthad. So it's been a while.
When I was just like refreshing my memory, it was supposed to be in celebration of the 20th year since the appearance of the sun. Are we still going by that, or are we kind of stretching our timeline and not necessarily?
I think we just don't specify.
We just
that.
Don't mess it. Yeah.
Yeah. We don't even
yeah,
need to go
another
there.
Question. How long does this feast last? Given we're talking about elves who are immortal, how long does this feast last? Is it?
Oh, weeks.
Days, months, years.
It's got to be. It's got to be for weeks, right?
Oh, yeah, it's got to be for a long time.
Yeah, I would think, right? Yeah, absolutely. They're in no rush. Besides, what do they have to, like, go back to the office on Monday morning? Like,
exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, what we said before is their perception of time is way different from ours, so it could go on for quite a while. I mean, very much like, I would imagine what they're probably trying to do is do something similar to what they experienced in Valinor on feast days.
Right.
Know?
Right.
So there should be some similarities, by the way. Of, you know, that an eagle-eyed viewer would see. Oh, yeah, they got that from Valinor.
Right. I'm thinking like a month. A month would be about how long the Marathatterthad would go. And now, I don't know exactly how we convey that, or if we need to bother conveying that.
There might be ways, you know, the writing team might find or want to have there be ways to, to refer to time passing. It probably in conversations with people encounters. Showing the face of the moon. Yes, Ellen, that's true. That's another good way to do it.
Yeah, that's true.
Actually, you could incorporate that in pretty easily, too.
I would think the primary thing that would move it along, right? I mean, again, they don't have to get back to work on Monday, but seasonal change would be like, I mean, especially if it's a harvest, if it happens at harvest time, right? Then, like, winter is starting to set in. We should probably head home would be the natural thing.
I was thinking that, too. I was thinking more like a season, you know, like a quarter. Like Lunasa to Samhain kind of thing, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, or they just go until they run out of food and booze.
Exactly. They have to eat their way through their massive stores. Yeah.
In which case... Yeah, you know, there's nothing left for the winter, so oh well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, priorities. Okay, that makes sense. Well, see, we've gone well beyond music commissions and conceiving the Marathatterthad.
I'm going to add this now. We talked about hunting. I mean, I could definitely see like there being a big hunt. You know, like fox hunting.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
They all get together and stuff.
Sure.
So I can see that being a big thing. In fact, I could even see that being like, okay, we've eaten all of this stuff from our host. We now need to do a hunt.
Let's go hunt. Yeah. Exactly. I'm now imagining an elvish celebration, which begins with the planting of the seeds in the spring and ends when that grain is harvested and ground. Right?
I mean,
we eat
good.
The bread that we, you know, from the seed that we planted at the beginning of the party. Yeah.
And you know, I could totally see that, given the nature of this celebration, you know, to be that, and that would totally be in keeping with these guys because they don't have really seasons to seasons. Just are like, you know, nothing.
Right.
Blink of an eye.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Exactly. It's. This all this all makes sense.
Please try to do some more slides for me.
Oh, yeah, no problem. No problem. Okay, we're going. We're moving on. I was just about to do that. All right. Mithrim. Okay, so Harangil, he is our cartographer, our film cartographer. He's begun work on a map showing the two camps across the lake from one another at Mithrim. It has been suggested that Fingolfin will stay at that site, eventually turning it into his fortress, so we would have the opportunity of showing the gradual transformation of the initial tent city into a fortress as time passes. So how is this large camp being supplied with food and lumber, etc., and also any requests for other areas that need maps? All right, so let's focus on the growing city by the shores of Lake Mithrim. I love this idea, as of course a city by the lake makes a lot of sense. It has to be fortress-like because everything up in the north is going to be, and you know, with you know Fingolfin and you know all of those. They're all going to be very oriented on the war with Morgoth, so it's not like he would just make an open, undefended city there. But at the same time, Mithrim is in the middle, right? I mean, it's not going to be like front line of fortifications. It's an inner fortification. So I would think it would have walls, clearly, but I wouldn't think it would be first and foremost a massive fortification, really. I think that... I think that they would certainly, it seems to me, therefore, that the opportunity would be for the city by Lake Mithrim would be the one place of like peace. And again, there would be vigilance there, but it wouldn't be primarily oriented on vigilance and defense. It would be the one sort of comparatively open and beautiful city. Yeah, no, exactly, Marie. There are ways through the mountains, but that's what they would be focused on defending, right? So all their defenses would be set up at the mountain passes. Again, they're not going to just have an open, totally undefended city anywhere, but I would think that it would be the least fortified of any of the cities in the north. And... also, this... is the only city I can think of in Beleriand. We get very few lakeside cities in Beleriand. That's not a common feature. And the city here by Mithrim is therefore an interesting kind of opportunity. Yeah, Nick says maybe even some structures that have been built outside the walls as the city expands. Exactly. But no, like none of the major, you think of the major centers, like the major places where action happens, the places we're going to visit during the season, right? You've got Nevrast on the coast, which is the closest thing, and of course the Havens, obviously. But again, almost everything else is on hills or in forests, right? We don't get really, like, city next to a large lake. So Mithrim is a really interesting opportunity, I think, to show. So what I would suggest to Harangil as far as thinking about maps and how the city develops, I think it would be really fun if the city developed. We saw the city developing sort of with the lake, right? Like, not just a city that happens to be near the lake. I'm not thinking necessarily we go full lake town with the city. But maybe even something like that, perhaps. You know, maybe there's like an island that there's a bridge to. Maybe they have parts of it built out over the water. But I would think that like the opportunity to show them interacting with the lake, as far as the actual structure of the city is concerned, would be kind of fun, would be kind of interesting. I absolutely agree, certainly, Ellen, that they have to be able to hunt and farm and all that kind of thing. Yes, Sure, but I think we can have plenty of open land around there to sort of show that agriculture is able to happen and that kind of thing. That doesn't seem to me to be super challenging there. I don't know that climate wise, I think we're still south of tundra. I don't think we have to be thinking about tundra here. Remember that, I'm not sure we have to go that far. It's northern, but I don't think that we have to necessarily make the terrain like tundra there. I don't know. I don't think that we're restricted in that way necessarily. I mean, we know the Helcaraxa goes over there, but it's not right next to it, necessarily. And we know that Utumno was further north, before. So it's not in the northern extreme. exactly. The Helcaraxa is north of Mithrim. I don't think we have to imagine it certainly not north beyond the tree line at all. I don't see any reason we can't have forests in Hithlum. That seems to me perfectly acceptable. We're north, but we're not that far. I mean, the Angband isn't polar. I really don't think that we have to go there.
Did we talk about Ruth brought up a little while ago, and it kind of scrolled by me, the fact that we are still on a flat Earth. You know, it's not a sphere yet.
Yes.
I don't know that we would necessarily... So two things about that for me. One is that, to me, that just opens it up in terms of who knows what the weather's like. Sure, there could be seasons. I mean, it doesn't mean anything. I mean, I don't think the physics that we know in our world now would necessarily apply.
Yes.
And that's the other thing I was going to say is I think we need... But the other thing I... Oh, no, I know the other thing I was going to say is we don't want to get too far. Like, you know, the viewers would be like, I don't understand, why... this or you know what I mean is but I just think we need to kind of unhinge ourselves a little bit or unhook ourselves a little bit from like physics as we know it or meteorology as we know it ourselves.
And from from round earth
yes.
climate
physics
yeah no absolutely that yeah. makes sense
And, you're right, Marie. We wouldn't have a tropical location right next to a polar one,
right,
but
right.
there certainly could be seasons. I mean, it could be a whole entire, like winter, polar could be more of a season, right, over all of Middle Earth at the same time. And then it's
right.
Well,
now,
tropical.
There are clear differences. I mean, it is part of this story that the north is colder than the south.
Yeah.
Like, that's fine. We can do that.
Yeah.
But again, I don't think we need to be... So, Ellen, I know you're thinking about Ard Galen in particular. I do not think that we need to... Yes, Ard Galen is open. Grassland, sure. But I don't think that that means we have to associate it with, with tundra above the northern tree line. Like, I don't think we have to go there. We can just make it grassland. That's all we need to do is make it a grassland. Make it a northern prairie, We'll see, but Ellen, the question is, Ellen, you ask, why are trees unable to grow there? I don't know. The question is not why are they unable to grow there. The question is why don't they grow there? And I don't know the answer to that question, but why should anybody need to know the answer to that question? Answer, because Yavanna didn't plant them there. I don't know.
That's another reason why I think we can't compare it to what we know today.
Exactly. Exactly, Ellen. In our world, it's step for a reason. But this is not our world. It's not a round Earth, right? And so, therefore, there might be reasons, but those reasons don't have to be the same reasons as in our world. That's exactly what Trish is saying, and I think that makes a lot of sense.
I have to laugh with Tolkien. You totally get what interests him, and you totally get what doesn't interest
yes.
him in his writing.
Yes.
You know, like, he doesn't do a lot of sketching of this kind of stuff. He doesn't really, like, he doesn't think about this stuff. You know, what would the effects of a flat earth? He just doesn't think about that. Just like with battles and stuff, he doesn't really get into all the military logistical stuff. You know what I mean? It's like,
right.
It's so funny because it's
yes.
like, yeah, he wasn't really into this.
Or the economic systems, right?
Or
also, another thing
exactly.
that he does not
exactly.
get into exactly. very much. It's not that trade never happens or anything like that.
Off camera, you know.
But yeah, no, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Like, yeah, of course they would need to have that, but that's not part of my story. Same thing with, like, seasons and things like that. It's not that. I mean, he had to actually go back, didn't he, like, with the phases of the moon? That was like a retrofit, wasn't it, that he did at some point where he went had
yeah.
to go back and, like,
yeah, yeah.
Match it up.
Well, with The Hobbit, certainly he did.
Yeah, with The
he
Hobbit,
wanted
yeah.
to he needed to
yeah.
do some retrofitting. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anyway, but no. So the and you know this is a big can of worms that I'm not going to open right now. The whole question about the connection between Middle Earth and our world. We can see in Morgoth's Ring the trouble that that ended up taking Tolkien into.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I think it's a big mistake. Like, I do not think we need to be tied to that. I think that Tolkien himself clearly had some major issues with that as far when it actually came to working it out. And I think the stuff that we get in the beginning of the Misconceived section in Morgoth's Ring shows him really struggling with some of this stuff in what I think are pretty destructive ways. I really hate his astronomical reconsiderations. It makes sense, but only if you grant the one initial, only if you cling stubbornly to the idea that this was our world. And I think if you're willing to let that go, Tolkien, the world that Tolkien himself made makes much more sense than when he
yeah.
tried to make it fit exactly the more he thought about it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think that was, I would strongly disagree with Tolkien on that. I would say, dude, your stories are better. Leave it. Just leave it. It's okay.
Yeah,
if it's a different world.
It's much better, like, as considered a sub-created world like Narnia, or, you know, I could think of a lot of other stories. I mean, the tradition in fairy stories is you don't make it on Earth, you know.
Right, exactly. And Tolkien did that, and he did that for a reason, and it's interesting to sort of see how that grew. But again, I don't think that does not seem to me a law that we need to conform with. Again, Tolkien's world yeah. doesn't conform to that law in general. When
yeah.
he tried to make it conform better and better, he got into more and more trouble. So, you know, there are things that we need to do in order to make sure that things make sense. Marie, exactly as you said, if we have, you know, a polar region and then a tropical region right
yeah.
next door to each
yeah.
other, that's just going to be weird and dissonant and bizarre and that's a thing that would demand an explanation, right? We don't want to include things that demand explanations that make our readers say, what on earth is going on? This is just like a random arbitrary thing. We don't want to make it feel random and arbitrary, but that doesn't mean we have to tie ourselves exactly to all other kinds of things. William wants to know if there are any islands in the lake. I think there could be islands. Of course, you know, William, I was thinking about islands, and the first thing I was thinking of when I was thinking about islands was Kvivienin, right? And to what extent might we want to... that would be kind of poignant, actually, to recall Kvivienin at Mithrim. Mostly, especially because, of course, Mithrim was the site of conflict, right? Or at least of near conflict, right? There was the place of tension between the two branches of the Noldor there. Recalling Kvivienin might be kind of interesting, actually. I don't know if we wanted to do that explicitly, but I think that that's kind of... That would be kind of interesting to have Kvivienin to be recalling Kvivienin and because that kind of recollection. So for that reason alone, I would think there should be islands. How much we want to make of that, you know, we can sort of see. But I would kind of want there to be islands. Ellen had asked a great question, which is what happens to the Feanorian camp? So the Feanorians move away, right? Fingolfin makes his camp into a city. And the Feanorians move away. What happens to the Feanorian camps? I would think it gets occupied, right? It becomes a, doesn't have to become a second city. So
it would seem like one of two things would happen, right? Either it would be a site that would become occupied and would become like a sister city to Fingolfin City, or it would be desolate, right? Would people have enough ill will for the Feanorians that they would be like, this is where the Feanorians settled, we shall never again, like, there will be tumbleweeds rolling around there for all time, and we're gonna, you know, leave that, like, the, you know, that ground is cursed as far as we're concerned, right? I don't think so. I don't think Fingolfin would let that happen.
I agree.
He at least wants to work together enough that I don't think he is going to encourage his people to, you know, sort of like maintain a constant memorial to how horrible the Feanorians are. I think that would be counterproductive completely. Nick, I agree there would be multiple smaller towns on the lake shores, and it could become one of them, or it could be one of the biggest ones. So I would just think that it would grow into a companion town or city. And as for the supplies with food and lumber and stuff, I would think there would be certainly plenty around there for them to live. I don't think there's any problem. Oh, Ellen, I have no object to there being a cold climate. None at all. I'm just saying it doesn't have to be Arctic. It doesn't have to be polar. That's all. I mean, you know, Canada's cold, but it's not all polar. That's all I'm saying. And there's plenty of, you know, there's forests and there's also grassland, right? So that's all. I mean, it can be like, I no problems with there having harsh winters and the climate being significantly colder. That's all totally fine. Exactly, Tony. It doesn't need to be Winterfell. No, it does not need to be Winterfell. Okay, cool. Any other areas that need maps? Yes. I want a map of Himring. I want a map of Mythros's fortress. Or network of fortresses. I mean, the March of Mythros, right? How did the defenses work at the March of Mythros? I would like to know. See, there are some things that are relatively simple, like the passes in the mountains into Hithlum, right? There are several passes. You need fortresses to defend the passes. I don't feel like I need a map for those, right? But the March of Mythros, what does Mythros do? How does Mythros create fortifications in order to inhibit the armies of Morgoth coming through that much broader area, right? I'd be very interested to see that. A map of the Nargothrond area, Ellen, I agree, that would be useful because it would help in conceiving. One of the things we're going to need to show a lot, right, is, so remember the kind of the balance we were trying to maintain with Nargothrond, where it was hidden but not secret, right? Unlike Gondolin, which, like, nobody even knows where on the continent Gondolin is, it's known, the region that Finrod lives in, and he wants it to be part of the war, right? He's not retreating from the war. He's not isolating himself from everybody else, but part of the strength of Nargothrond is that its entrance is secret. People don't know exactly how to get to it. So how do we do that? How do you have, what is the area like that, you know, around like that? How do they contrive to keep the entrance a secret? Because we're going to have to do this. We're going to have to show people going and coming, and we can't have a highway, right? But what does it look like when there's not a highway? Are there geographical features that make it sort of easier to hide? Not only the place, having the hidden gates to the city is not itself very difficult. I'm just thinking of like the approaches to the city. How do you make people able to come and go, as people clearly do come and go with some frequency from Nargothrond, without betraying the location, right? So that's what I would want to be to sort of see how that could be contrived. And a map, I think, might be really helpful for us as we're thinking about how people go and come from Nargothrond without, again, like tramping a path straight up to the front door that anybody could follow. The Minas Tirith area, Ellen, yeah, one of the things that I would like to understand better is that that island, that fortress that Finrod builds up there, what's the point of it? Is it just guarding the river crossing? I want to make sure, I think a map might help us to show what, because, like, to be honest, on the map, right, on the Beleriand map, Minas Tirith, it's not obvious the tactical importance of Minas Tirith from the map, right? I mean, like, it's kind of located there in the gap, but the gap is big enough that when you look at the map, you're like, we'll go around it, right? How hard is that, right? I mean, okay, so there's a fortress there, and, you know, like, if you're marching an army and there's an army in the fortress, you can't just walk past it and wave as you go by, because then they'll come out and attack you from behind, right? So I'm not saying that, but I would want it to be more than that, right? Just to sort of show why he chose that spot, why that spot is an important spot, and the significance of that. And William, I think that you're right it might be useful to start thinking about a map of Tol Sirion and a map of Minas Tirith itself, because we're going to want one. When it's time to rescue Beren, we don't absolutely need one. I would put that as a lower priority of some other things, because it's not really until we need to rescue Beren that we're going to need to know more about how it's structured, right? But it would be interesting. So those would be, I think, my top requests for maps. We won't need this until next season, but just to kind of throw this out there, Nan Elmoth, like Eol's Nan Elmoth, it doesn't necessarily have to have funky geography, but I think that it might. I don't know. I want to kind of picture it more. Anyway, okay. Those are my suggestions about maps. All right, let's keep going. So the sun. So we celebrated the rising of the sun at the end of last season, and we've had the sun and moon for a whole season, but we haven't said too much about that. I think this is a great question to raise. What effect will it have on Beleriand? I'll keep going. They decided that the sleep of Yavanna was mostly lifted at the awakening of the elves, so life cycles have continued. But now we have a sun, so what changes? How do we show the world blossoming? Blossoms, chiefly. The primary thing that I think... blossoms! Yeah, flowers would be my number one thing. The difference between season 3 and season 4 doesn't have to be like like Dorothy landing in Oz necessarily, right? Like, it doesn't have to be that exaggerated, the shift from black and white to ridiculous color in the land of the Munchkins. But I think it, that should be one of the primary things. Color should be one of the primary things, right? That the thing about the world by starlight, it wasn't dark. We can't show it dark or whatever, you know, you won't be seeing anything over the course of the whole film. But there will have been lots of very muted colors. Right. Certainly more flowers, more vibrancy and diversity of life there.
You know, going back to my thing about, you know, we can't use our own physics. I mean, how about rain? You know, have we had rain prior to the sun coming up? I mean, because, you know, in our world, the heating of the air, you know, contributes to the cloud formations and blah, 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 blah. But I don't know that we need to adhere to that. And is rain required for the things to grow, or do they just grow? Like, is Yavanna's magic enough just for them to grow? Yeah. I don't have a boat one way or the other. I'm just...
Yeah. Oh, I didn't even think of the rain question. That's a really good question.
I mean, after it goes round, for sure, we would have rain, I would think. But at this point, I don't know. I just, you know, just throwing it out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would think the elves would love rain. If it does rain, it would not be the thing where, oh, we must find cover. You know, I would totally see the elves like being out in the rain.
Oh, yeah.
It would just be another form of... You know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's kind of interesting to ponder because, again, we're not chained to our own world's natural laws here.
And again, as soon as we start,
Yavanna could be sufficient to grow this thing. So.
And especially as soon as we start thinking about this stuff, I mean, we get right back into the issue that we had with the sleep of Yavanna, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fact is that Tolkien's stories depict forests before there is sun, right? I mean, like that's it happens, right? And, you know, the decision that we made was to ease up on the sleep of Yavanna thing, because that seems to me like an actual flat contradiction in Tolkien's world. But it's like, okay, because the Silmarillion isn't really interested in that kind of element of storytelling. It's not how the Silmarillion works. But we need to be thinking about that a little bit more. I don't think that we make a big deal of the rain. The more I think about it, I'm thinking, yeah, there definitely will have been precipitation before.
I mean, there's snow up north, right? So
yeah,
obviously,
exactly.
You know. I think one of the things for me is just, okay, so if we do have rain, let's not have every single scene be sunny blue sky all the time. You know, there needs to be some variation.
Yeah.
I miss diversity today. Can you tell?
It's like, yeah.
Variation in body size, variation in weather. You know, I mean, it's just, I don't know. I mean, that always bugs me in movies where you only see like the weather is static, you know, through the whole entire show, which is so not realistic for us. But, you know, all bets are off for this, so I don't even know. But yeah, I think.
And you make an excellent point, Trish, about the reaction of elves to rain, that elves wouldn't necessarily just be taking shelter from the rain, right?
Right.
It's not to say that they never take shelter from the rain under any circumstances, but I agree with you. I wouldn't necessarily think that that would be their number one. I'm sort of imagining, like, what would Noldor rain gear be like? I think that Noldor would design fabrics that would, like, look even more awesome when they were wet.
When they were wet,
right? Would like you know, sort of shed
and like
would right or and would also like dry more easily, so that you don't, you know, you don't just walk around like a drowned rat right after you've been soaked. So yeah, they would have. Yeah, that all would. That all would. Would that just seems to me that's the kind of direction the Noldor would probably think, right? It would be rain would be for those, you know, for those Noldor whose artistry takes the form of, you know, textiles and things like that. They would, I mean, rain would be a delightful artistic challenge.
Oh, yeah.
It wouldn't be
absolutely
something that you would have to just apply your ingenuity to avoiding.
I mean, this is another difference too. I mean, maybe the Sindar Duke take cover. You know, and the Noldor don't, and the Green Elves don't. You know, I mean, it's just, it could be another difference between the races or the factions. I don't know. It's just, it's kind of an interesting, again, this would be something that would play out kind of in the background or just part of the scenery kind of thing, but still, it's worth thinking about.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Maybe the Sindar apply themselves to making cloaks, like Ellen is recalling, of course, the cloaks in the Lord of the Rings, right, which are made by Nandor.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's right.
Maybe they apply themselves to, like, cloaks which actually do a really great job of shedding water, like waterproof cloaks.
Right.
Whereas the Noldor are like, no, why waterproof when you can, like, exploit the water in, like, really awesome ways, artistically, right? Yeah.
Like, new designs show up on their clothing when it gets wet, you know? I mean, that
right.
kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just like, I must put my cloak on.
Right. Right. Yeah, no, there are all kinds of things that they could do there, I think. I think we can show differences there, but that would be fun. Anyway, I don't think we have a problem with rain.
Now, with this climate change and also the world blossoming also brings up, and we did touch on it, but I just want to say it again. So we do have, like, a harvest season, right? So
yeah.
There are seasons.
Yeah, we are going to do seasons.
Yeah, so I would imagine that there would be a climate change that would, you know, match the seasons. Again, they don't necessarily have to track with us, but something.
Yes. That would be interesting, actually. But I don't know how we could convey this in a way that wouldn't simply be confusing if the seasons were in some way different from ours. One thing that should not happen. I mean, if we want to think about flat Earth astronomy at all, the one thing that should not happen is change of the length of day and night.
Right.
So whatever might happen with, there could be other reasons for, temperature changes, you know, for seasons, the difference between summer and winter. There can be other factors that contribute to that. But I don't believe that the nights would be longer in the wintertime. We made the decision a long time ago not to worry too much about the astronomy. And I think that we should stick with that. But Elle and I like the idea of winter as a kind of counterattack of Morgoths.
It also could have been in the music. Remember how in the beginning when they formed Middle Earth and,
yes,
you know, they
would almost talking about snowflakes and
down,
he would
counter them. So I could totally see that being also the case with even climate. You know, they make it warm and Melkor comes along and makes a band that's not, you know, that's polar or something. I don't know.
Right.
Polar's not really the right word. But.
Right. And I agree, Phil, it is possible that the sun, could change where it go, like that is, it doesn't always have to go in exactly the same track, right? It can,
mm-hmm.
it can shift and go further to the north and go further to the south. That wouldn't necessarily change the length of the day or night, but it would change the temperature.
The temperature. That's true.
But having there be a more combative element to it, I think to me is perfectly fine, I suspect. As we said before, I don't want to worry too much about the astronomy. I think that we don't have to worry about it too much. I don't think that we talk about it at all. But I have no problems with seasons. Phil points out that Yavanna might want the sun to move around and distribute light to her plants more evenly. She might put in a particular request of that kind. Who knows? The moon would have phases based on its proximity to the sun, right? And like whether, you know, so because he's on, he is uneven in his course. But again, I don't think so. Are there phases of the moon? Sure, I think we can have phases of the moon. But again, we don't need to explain why we have phases of the moon, because we can have different explanations. We are not, as Trish said, we are not tied to the scientific or astronomical explanations of things in our world, right? Because it is very clear, whatever might be the future destiny of this world is not yet our world because it is flat,
right.
And our world is not. And so therefore, by definition, it cannot operate under exactly the same rules. Yeah. So, anyway, more kind of mythic explanations of many of these things, like winter being, you know, the cold breath of Morgoth spreading out over the land, or an eclipse being an attack upon the sun, right? I mean, these kinds of mythic explanations can be, at least to some extent, quite literally true. Like that, we're still kind of in that world here in the early Silmarillion, especially, you know, before the making of the world flat and the separation of Valinor. I mean, there's a major metaphysical change that happens beyond the purely physical and astronomical change of the making the world round.
Round, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway,
that's going to be a big deal. I mean, that we'll have to spend some time on that in season 17 for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no question.
Or 20.
Yeah.
Didn't we talk about timekeeping previously?
I think
in terms of how the elves, Phil and Marie and the Grant gang can probably set us straight on that.
Yeah.
Oh, they use the trees in Valinor.
They use the trees in Valinor, but here they use the sun.
Sun.
And we do have years of the
sun. And the moon,
now.
I assume, right? Because is the moon going to have phases? That's another thing. I don't even know if
the moon
has phases.
No, yeah, we briefly mentioned that. I think that they should have phases. The moon should have phases. But again, it's not necessarily for the same reasons, but that's fine. Like it's
for us, yeah. Well, I think, like you say, if the sun is doing sort of a spiral trajectory, then I think you could probably argue that, because that's the whole deal. It's right. It's the shadow of us and the sun. And, you know, you could still have that effect on the moon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Phil says someone needs to set up a simulation. Yeah, that'd be good.
A science project.
That would be a great science project. Seasonal variations in a flat Earth. Yes. Yeah. Why not? Oh, and you've done that science project? There we go. Yeah. Flat Earth astronomy.
But we have to make it flat Middle Earth astronomy to make
sure
we have
flat Middle Earth astronomy. That's it. Okay.
You've got the mythic side of it and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Are we going on to the next slide?
We are. Exciting. Next slide.
Oh my god.
Next slide. Here we go. Magic swords. Okay. So we're reforging Ringil. We have Tel'kar, and we're going to bring in Narsil later on. Of course, we're going to have Anglachel and stuff as we move forward, too. How do we want to depict these scenes? Is it solely smithcraft with a forge in fire, or is there some singing involved? Is it private, secretive, or is there something you can do in front of others? I think you can do it in front of others. I don't think it has to be private.
Well, I think if it is private, there may be some that, like Aeol, may do private, right? And if it is private, there's something not off about doing it privately. You know what I mean? There's something like an ulterior motive that's questionable or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That it should be public. And if it isn't public, then something's hinky there.
Right. Exactly. My suggestion as far as secrecy is concerned, that Aeol should be secretive.
Yes.
And that is like a huge red flag. Right.
Right. Exactly.
Huge red flag. So in fact, like that can be a conversation point, you know, between Tel'kar and Aeol, right? Aeol, you know, Tel'kar sees the black swords and is like, well, you kept that quiet, right? You know, like it can be kind of a big deal that, you know, he did that on his own alone. Ringil's reforging, I think, should be not exactly a public ceremony necessarily, but should.
I would think it would be celebratory too, you know, I mean, right? I mean, not necessarily like fireworks and all that stuff, but still something really publicly acknowledged as something special.
Yeah. I mean, I think that would something that would be a very public event, the reforging of Ringil.
Now on the other hand, I could see dwarves being secretive, and that could be actually even where Aeol gets encouraged to be secretive about his forging. Don't you think? I mean, not secretive in the sense of dwarves among, you know, what's, you know, stays with the dwarves and not public.
Nick is calling
other
on that as well, but I want to let's I'm not sure about this. Okay, so secrecy and the dwarves. Yes, the dwarves are secretive to other peoples.
Right. To other
peoples. But among themselves?
Not to themselves. No, I agree. Among themselves. That's what I'm, yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure that the, I mean, are there, I don't think we're talking about trade secrets here, right? Like, I can't let you watch me reforging my magic sword or else you might figure out how to reforge magic swords. Yeah. Just
I was
powerful.
Actually thinking psychologically that dwarves just wouldn't be, you know, they're kind of already on the defensive anyway, being sort of foster children. And, you know, it's kind of like it's nobody else's business but ours kind of thing. Not trade secret wise, but just they're like ultimate introverts as a society.
Maybe, yeah. No, I mean, Nick, I agree with you that dwarves are not merely xenophobic. They're jealous in a way that other people aren't. Yes. Jealous, yes, but...
defensive, I would almost say. Like, yes. Defensive. Like the whole foster child thing, you know? I mean, it's something that kind of is ingrained in them. They're not really... they were add-ons that Eru said, oh, okay, I'll adopt them. And I assume they know that, even if they don't know it consciously.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, actually talking this way, though, it makes the whole thing with Aale even stand out, the fact that they would even include him.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, no, I agree. So, I'm thinking more
We do get
this.
To this later, right? I mean, we do get to the dwarves being this way later. Is what you're pondering is, are they that way now? Is that what you're kind of pondering? Because I mean, I don't think it's a question that they definitely become not xenophobic, but very insular.
The specific
later,
question right? that I'm pondering is, what kind of community is there among dwarvish craftsmen? That's the specific. Like, so
I got
do
it.
They Tel'kar?
Do they share recipes?
Yeah. Does she share recipes? Would she teach others? Would they? I mean, is it? Are they? Do they jealously guard the secrets of their own craftsmanship? They jealously possess the fruits of their own craftsmanship, right? I mean, but that doesn't seem to me the same thing or necessarily attached. Like, if you have a very high opinion of property rights, you know, like if that is to say, if you so you you know that you forged it, you own it. Right. And nobody else has any rights to it. That's a different thing than saying, and you're not willing to like show anybody how to do what you can do at the forge.
Right. Right.
Those two things right. could be connected with each other. But that's what I mean by trade secrets. Right. I don't know that they would necessarily be like, I've developed a secret technique to make the swords I make more awesome, but I'm not going to share it with anybody else because I want my swords to carry on being more awesome than everybody else's swords. I don't know that dwarves would necessarily think that way. At least I'm not assuming that they would. They might. I'm not. It's certainly that kind of thinking would be consistent with the kind of jealous ownership concept. But it doesn't seem to me inescapably connected with it. Now, Maria's recalling, of course, the mortality of the dwarves. And how there would have to be a master passing on to the student, you know, trade secrets, or else, you know, they're going to have to reinvent things every generation.
Wouldn't you think we'd see more of like an apprentice journeyman kind of thing going on in dwarf right. society, craft society?
Yes.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, elves, I don't think it would even cross their minds. Next generation, what does that mean?
Well, right, exactly. Right. So in that, I mean, the one, cause see the clearest example of this kind of jealousy that we get is Feanor, right? Never telling anybody how he made the Silmarils.
Right. That's right.
I would, yeah. And again, one of the things I think that I'm pushing against is I wouldn't want to get too, I think it's easier to get too sort of, I don't know, stereotyped isn't the right word, too exaggerated, too sort of whitewashing, right? And being like the dwarves are kind of, you know, they're all jealous and territorial. I think we go too far with that, or we could go too far with that. And I'm not sure, like I say, I'm not opposed to at least some of them thinking like this. I'm just not sure that I would necessarily want it to be. And I'm thinking about how dwarves talk about it, right? I mean, there's definitely like an in-house dwarf thing, but, it's not obvious to me when dwarves are talking about the works of their fathers or the, you know, that they are, because they make stuff for other people all the time. I'm thinking, of course, here especially of The Hobbit, right? And Thorin's description of the old culture of the Lonely Mountain. You know, they'd sell their stuff all the time. And people who don't want, you know, their secrets in circulation would tend not to do that. And yes, Nick, The Hobbit does say something about people coming to be apprentices of the dwarves. Yes, it does. That's why I'm contemplating this distinction between openness of craft, right? That the dwarves delight in smithcraft and are happy to teach people smithcraft, and to learn from them and to teach them and to learn from them. But they are jealous of the materials or of the product, right? So like if you make, you know, just within dwarf culture, the, like, you made it, you own it, you know, unless you give it, or, you know, you can give it, you can sell it. It's not like that's forbidden, but the kind of the I would think that there would be a strong cultural assumption towards ownership, right? The idea of somebody else just like making off with something that somebody else made would be like an appalling, unthinkable thing in dwarvish culture. So theft would be like one of the capital crimes, right? Because nobody can understand it. But yeah, Tony, I don't know that I would go quite as far as the goblins in Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. Where they have such a strong idea of ownership that, like, if something is that, like, when they sell something to a human, the goblins understand that the price paid doesn't constitute transfer of ownership, but just usage of the thing for the lifetime of the human. So when the human dies, it's rightfully goblin property again. That's the concept that Rowling puts forward in the Deathly Hallows. Hallows, not Hallows. That's different. I don't know that they would go as far as that. I don't think we need to go quite as far, but, you know, in that kind of direction. William asks, how would this contrast with Silmaril ownership? Well, it wouldn't, other than Feanor's even more obsessive about it. Yeah, I name them unto myself forever. You know, I would think the dwarves could get behind that sentiment, right? Remember, it's Aule who is like, hang on, guys, you know, this is a big deal. This, you're asking a lot of him here. Right. When it came to the question of the breaking of. So I would think the dwarves also would very much understand Feanor's issue there. But I would think that that impulse, Feanor's impulse, Feanor's impulse is that's still a little twisted, though. And I would think that his secrecy about the Silmarils, just as when Feanor in Valinor shuts up the Silmarils and doesn't let other people see them, that's countercultural. Right. I would suspect. Right. I would suspect that his secrecy about how he made the Silmarils would also be countercultural.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that the general Noldor culture would be celebrating the skill, people's skill of hands, right? So if there's something that you develop that could help another artist use it themselves in a new and different way to create another and even more glorious thing, that's what you do, right? So the idea that someone would, like, do some kind of advance, you know, would be responsible for some kind of novel advance in technique and would not share that technique with anyone else, I would think would be at least a little countercultural. Like, I'm going to take these most beautiful things that I've made and I'm not going to let anybody else see them is countercultural and alarming. Certainly a red flag. And what's more, I also think that the Noldor would not have the same sense of ownership over things. They would, like, the making of the thing is its own reward. The fact that the thing exists and is being appreciated and, like, being used and appreciated and enjoyed, like, that's the thing that they would want, right? They wouldn't hoard it. They wouldn't necessarily keep it to themselves. Again, I'm not saying no Noldor ever does this. I'm just saying I think it's, I don't think that should be the dominant note of the culture. I think that with the, that seems to me the primary distinction with the dwarves. Both of them love craftsmanship. Both of them, at least inside their own cultures, share techniques, share learning. But the big difference is that the dwarves hold on to the things, have a much stronger view of possessiveness and property ownership than the Noldor do. I'm brainstorming here. This is me thinking off the top of my head. I could be convinced otherwise, but that's the direction I'm kind of thinking there. Yeah, exactly. Nick is pointing out how the Noldor give their gems freely to the Teleri. Yes, exactly. Exactly. That's the model that I'm kind of thinking of there. And yes, the idea of hoarding things, Marie, shows a twisted relationship to craft. The dwarves don't necessarily... It's not like all dwarves are born with dragon sickness necessarily, right? It is an evil that they are more prone to. Yeah. Anyway, okay. Well, I've both strayed away from the main topic here, and I am running out of time. So let's come back to this one. We'll do more about magic swords. So the two questions that we still have to think more about are, as far as the magic swords are concerned, are what is the process like? Wherein does the magic lie, and how do we want to depict that? And then specific also design questions. For swords and thoughts on shield designs and stuff. So we'll talk about some of that stuff more later on. So we'll come back to the magic sword question. But we did accomplish some things with the magic sword. Awesome. Well, this was just as much fun as I hoped. I am telling you, this has been this kind of thing. This is why we digress so often. Thinking through these kinds of things, right? Doing this kind of adaptation world building as we're thinking, you know, kind of taking these things here and there that Tolkien says about this stuff and really kind of living there, right? Really kind of developing that into, you know, answering some of these broader questions that the texts themselves in no way answer or could answer. This is, to me, one of the most entertaining elements of film from the beginning. So these creative sessions where we get to do nothing but that, oh my gosh, that is such a privilege. So thanks everybody for joining me for this today. That was really great. I look forward to our next. So next session will be, we're still back on schedule. So the 31st, 2 weeks from now, is when we will be back for our next session. And at that time, we will talk about episodes 5 and 6. So we already laid a lot of groundwork for the Marathotterthod. What's going on in the background? What are people eating and drinking and doing? And we will begin thinking through the actual plot and story of that episode, as well as episode 6 as the rumors and suspicions about the kinslaying are spreading across the land. So, excellent. Thanks, everybody, for joining us today. And thanks, Trish, for all of your contributions and help, as always. And I will say, as I always do, thanks for listening, and Godspeed.